From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It's the 26th day of June, 2020. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Mike Zuzlow at GlobalAnalytics.biz. Look at the agricultural weather forecast with Eric Snodgrass from Nutrien Ag Solutions. Laura Christensen, crop scientist from here on campus, will discuss saturated buffers and how research suggests they will be very helpful. Oh, and we'll talk about spider mites, too. Ooh, you haven't heard about that one for a while, and it probably said drought in your mind a little bit in the way of dry conditions across the state. And we'll discuss all of that right today here on the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Corn futures finished the day lower, July down a quarter at 317, December 2¾ lower at 325 and a quarter, and March corn 336 and three quarters down 2¾. July beans off 4¼ at 865, November 861 and a quarter down 7. The bean oil 34 cents lower, the bean meal down 340. Wheat futures were off 12 and three quarters for the soft red at 474 and July hard red at 421 and a quarter. 8.5 cents lower. Live cattle futures in the August, a nickel lower at $96.25. Feeders were down 65 cents for the day at $132.60. And July lean hogs down $1.65 at $45.27.5. Mike Zuzlow is here from Global Analytics in Atchison, Kansas. What happened in Chicago today?
Well, Todd, you know the computers are running the show when you have a dust storm approaching the United States and you have locusts in three of the five continents that we have that grow crops. So we've got a real issue with the markets when it comes to this pre-report and U.S.-China trade negotiations, phase one rhetoric that it started out this week with Mr. Navarro from the Trump administration saying that it was essentially over. And it kind of bookended on Friday's trade with China messaging to diplomats from the United States that if we cross red lines in Taiwan and Hong Kong and a couple other areas, then we are jeopardizing the commitments made for the phase one trade deal. So as expected, and this is coming from the Wall Street Journal and South China Morning Post is also reporting it now, but we're essentially moving in the wrong direction, in my opinion, not unexpected in terms of what China is doing heading into our elections, starting to play more hardball. But our leader, the wheat, really took it on the chin. And with even though we had this dust storm and all these locust issues, we're hitting fresh nine-month lows in the wheat market. And that really closed out the week and put us into really the trade, I think, is just essentially saying to itself, all we have now is missed rains over the weekend, first of next week, to heal this market until we get USDA's numbers past us.
All right. Well, we can talk about those fundamentals of rainfall, but we'll know more when they happen. And yeah, because we're low enough now, it doesn't matter very much, I don't think, at least in pricing anything out. Next week's grain stocks and acreage numbers could very well be really important. One of them looks like it, well, if it was at 97 million acres for corn, that would be seriously bearish still. The other one looks like it has some potential. The grain stocks number could show usage or disappearance to be faster than expected. I suppose on the livestock, are you in that camp?
Yeah, I mean, I think the industrial side and the feed demand side are just as good, if not better, than they have been, minus the 45 days of major hit we took to the demand side because of COVID. It's the export market that is still needing to kind of lick its wounds and is slowly rebuilding. But yeah, I mean, when I saw the estimates and the average trade estimates on stocks being all of them, corn, beans, and wheat, down below last year as of June 1, that would be meet my expectations and actually make me quite friendly to the market that we haven't oversupplied the market because of COVID. That's probably the biggest thing I'm watching for in the grain stocks report. Do we get extra supplies thrown at us by USDA and we aren't actually below last year's numbers because we've taken a bigger demand hit? But as we just said, as I just said, I don't think that should happen given the hogs and pigs report and given the cattle on feed report. So my mindset is that if we can come in below last year on stocks and we can come in with the average trade guess of 95 million acres on corn, all of a sudden we're talking about being just below a 3 billion bushel carryover in the corn. And while that is still extremely large, and I recognize that, we're still also a dollar lower than we were a year ago at this time. So I think we can encourage further demand. And if we have some weather supply scares, we can rebuild some premium into this market in the month of July.
So what did you make of that hogs and pigs report released yesterday afternoon?
Yeah, you know, you and I have talked about this on a different number of cases, whether it's the end of the week like this Friday afternoon or whether it's a commodity week. And I think what we were feeling and sensing anecdotally is exactly what USDA put out. In other words, the kept for breeding number dropped down to 99%. And we're actually down, I think, about 2% when it comes to farrowings for June to August. So the big animals got liquidated more than the small animals, and the big animals got euthanized more than the small animals. And that's why the all hogs and pigs were at the top end of the range of 105. So supply is burdensome right now. But I'd also say between the cold storage stocks seeing a record drop for the month of May, and then the kept for marketing's number on this hogs and pigs report being above the highest trade guess at 106%, you've also got very strong demand. So between the exports and the domestic demand numbers, I think you've got a balanced market, and 45-cent hogs should be the bottom end of the range at this stage, unless we see another big wave of COVID, which that is on the radar screen right now.
Okay, and finally, put the anchor on this one, and not an anchor, as it may weigh the market down, though that may be the case, but the one that gives you direction, which has been the wheat market. We started with that. Why don't you finish with it?
It's not looking good. We've got a 9-month low in the soft red, and the hard red did not see so far a counter seasonal rally. And I think we have seen dropping yields as we've migrated the hard red wheat harvest away from the Oklahoma border. And so I'm hoping that next week we see a whole dynamic shift in the wheat, because we get away from the July deliveries, we get away from the July wheat, July corn spread, and we start to see more yield data come through that suggests that, okay, between the stocks and the acreage report, we are pretty tight in the United States heading into fall, knowing that our Gulf price is competitive with the Black Sea.
Hey, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
I appreciate you. Thanks, Todd.
That is Mike Zuzulo. He's with GlobalAnalytics.biz. Over the noon hour today, I joined the Extension Commercial Ag team for a Zoom meeting. We talk about the condition of the crop and other issues related to agriculture each and every Friday during the growing season. Most of them admitted that the rainfall from last week did a great deal to help the crop out and that it looked good. However, they were amazed by how quickly the moisture seems to be getting away. That brought us to Nick Sider, the Extension entomologist here on campus. He's been hearing about spider mites in southern Illinois. That's definitely a dry weather insect, or usually that's the case, he says.
Yeah, you're looking for discoloration of the plants at first. That's going to start out yellowish, and if it gets severe, of course, that leaf tissue starts to die and you get more of a brown appearance. When you look closely at those leaves, they're what's called stippled, where there's little spots of light and dark on the leaf. You'll often see the webbing that those spider mites leave behind, especially within the notches of the veins of the leaf. And if you look really closely, you might see the mites themselves crawling around on that leaf. If you look with a hand lens, you'll definitely see the spider mites and their eggs. In terms of thresholds, they're not real well defined. We talk about something like 10 to 25% discolored. But it's a judgment call, really, and what you're judging it on is how stressed out those plants are over how large an area and how soon that stress is going to be relieved. So spider mites perform very well on stressed out plants. Usually that's drought stress. When you get into this situation early, it could be a combination of stresses, drought, the cold temperatures that we had early, stunting plants, getting dinged by herbicides, all of these things can contribute, but drought tends to be the big driver.
And that's Nick Sider. He's an extension entomologist talking about the potential that spider mites might be showing up on soybeans in southern Illinois and how farmers can scout their fields and what thresholds they should use for treatment. You know, here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois, researchers are consistently looking into soil and water quality. Laura Christensen from the Crop Sciences Department in the College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences does just that. I asked her, in fact, what it is that she does.
My tagline for what I do is that we help farmers do what they do best in growing crops while keeping water clean. So we're interested in reducing nitrogen and phosphorus that we send downstream from our farms here in Illinois.
How do you set about accomplishing that goal?
Most of our, a large part of our research program involves farms across the state, both private farms and university research farms or partner farms, where we put conservation practices on the ground, and then we go out and monitor how well those conservation practices are working. That means we go out to these farms and collect water samples, bring them back to our lab, and analyze them to see how much nitrogen or phosphorus is in the water.
I know that you've been working with saturated buffers. Tell me about some of that research, please.
Well, saturated buffers is an important practice for us to be researching because it's a relatively new conservation practice over the last 5 or 10 years or so. And it's not a practice that's officially recommended in our state nutrient loss reduction strategy. And the reason for that is because it's a new practice. And there just wasn't enough data or, you know, science and research to confirm that it should be included as a recommended practice or it should not be included as a recommended practice. And so with our saturated buffers across the state, we're currently monitoring three. We go out to the site. We collect water samples. We look at how much water is getting routed into the saturated buffer. And then we analyze how well are these saturated buffers working. And towards the end of this year, really within the next 12 months or so, we're going to be digging deeply into our data to evaluate, is this a practice that we should recommend be added as a recommended practice in our nutrient loss reduction strategy?
I know you can't make a recommendation at this point, but do early indications point one way or the other?
Oh, yeah. Saturated buffers are a practice that works. That's clear. Their nitrogen is removed by the practice of a saturated buffer. Now, they're not perfect, but no practice is perfect. And one of the hardest things is really in the siting of the saturated buffer. Finding the right site is kind of the limiting factor right now, because you have to have a buffer or be willing to put a buffer in. And then there's characteristics of the soil in the buffer that have to be right. And so the siting is really the sticky part right now. But yeah, definitely saturated buffers are a practice that work to clean nitrogen from tile drainage.
What is it exactly?
Well, it's really in kind of scientific terms where we reconnect the hydrology at the edge of the field. Traditionally, with our tile drains, we have tile pipes that go straight from the field. They go straight underground if you have a buffer between the field and the stream. And those tile pipes go straight underground underneath that buffer and send that drainage water straight out to the stream. With a saturated buffer, we cut into that tile pipe or that tile main, and we route water to the side. So rather than going through the pipe to the stream, the water actually gets rediverted to flow through the buffer's soil, so it just seeps slowly towards the stream. And when the buffer gets, or when the water gets reconnected with how water would normally go to a stream, there's a lot of treatment that can happen with good microbes that live in the soil and plant uptake of the nitrogen and the water. And so we're just really kind of reconnecting the hydrology or reconnecting how the water is supposed to get to the stream.
It's not a wetland.
No, no. And it's actually kind of a misnomer a little bit. I like the term saturated buffer, but it's a little bit of a misnomer because you're not saturating the buffer all the way up to the surface. It's not going to be squeechy and squelchy when you step out on there, which the name kind of implies. And it's certainly not a wetland. You're not raising the water table in the buffer all the way up to the surface by any means.
So just thinking about this as a farm boy, if I have a ditch and I have a grass buffer along it, say 40 feet or something like that, in which normally the tile line would be under it and it would dump directly into the stream. In this case, you just sort of stop, make a hard right or left, and you leave the tile lines underground and let them seep into the soil at that point?
Well, it's slightly more complicated than that, but you do have the overall concept. What we do is cut into the tile main and insert what we call a control structure. So this is just a little box that serves as like a check dam or
a weir.
A weir, that's right, a weir underground. And then that control structure has pipes coming out of it on either side or sometimes both sides. And those pipes are perforated, normal perforated tile pipe or tile pipe that has holes in it. And so the water hits the check dam or hits the weir in the control structure and is sent to the side into one of those distribution lines. And those distribution lines, that perforated tile, that's how the water goes from being in that tile main through the control structure and then goes out into the buffer soil.
So it's just a lateral that allows the water to seep back into the soil profile?
That's right. That's right. It's just tile drainage working in reverse.
Sweet. Well, it's like a leach field.
But it is a powerful conservation drainage technology because your drainage system in the field can continue to function how you need that drainage system to function. But then at the edge of the field, you get this extra treatment for the nitrogen. So you get the drainage benefits, but you're also helping with our water quality.
What advice do you give farmers that are interested in installing a saturated buffet?
One of the first places to go is your local NRCS office, especially if you're interested in any cost share or incentive programs. They're really your best source of information. There's also some good sources of information across the Midwest. For example, if you go to transformingdrainage.org, they have some really nice fact sheets and information on saturated buffers across the Midwest.
Hey, thanks so much.
Thanks, Todd.
Laura Christensen is a crop scientist right here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. Eric Snodgrass now joins us from Nutrient Ag Solutions and Agrible to discuss the weather forecast. Hey, Eric, thanks so much. What a beautiful week it has been. However, I don't want to start here. Can we start a little further to the northwest and then work your way maybe from the Pacific Northwest and how that impacts us right across the Midwest, please?
Yeah, I think there's an interesting story playing out in the Pacific Northwest. And specifically what I'm talking about is they've not had a hot summer yet. In other words, every time it warms up, it's been brief and then a big shot at cooler air comes in. That's going to happen again. It's been problematic. You know, they need heat on their row crops, potatoes, onions, and things like that, and also on their wheat crop. But at the same time, they also don't like this frequent rain. It's interrupted hay cuttings numerous times. And I got off a phone call yesterday with some farmers in the Northwest, and they are asking me, shut this rain down and bring us in the heat. And I'm like, I can't do that. And it's going to go back over towards the cooler, wetter pattern. Now, this is what's neat about all of it. That pattern is being established in the North Pacific and over Siberia, where we've actually seen some incredibly high temperatures. And if you haven't seen this past week, a lot of fire activity. In a nutshell, what this has done is this has helped push the jet stream farther to the north. So that nicer weather we've had around here in Illinois, for example, we're going to be pulling into some much above average temperatures as we work through the next, not just week, but probably the next couple of weeks. So we're going to be getting temperatures that are going to get into the 90s at times. And this crop, which honestly, when I drive around central Illinois, looks a little shorter than I would normally think it would be this time of June, is going to take this heat and probably run with it. Now, in a field I stood in last week on last Friday, right now, that corn crop grew 18 inches on last week's heat. And I think it's going to shoot through the roof with some of the heat we got coming in. There's good news mixed in with a little bad news, though. The bad news first might be some severe storms in the form of squall lines that come out of the northern part of Illinois. I'm worried about those later on tonight and as we work our way through the weekend. But the good news is it's rain. So bringing in that rain as we work our way into July is critical. So this pattern is going to favor storms in the near term, and that's buying us time as we work our way through the growing season here by putting that rain down right here in the heart of the Corn Belt.
Is that a storm every 3 to 5 days, meaning rainfall?
Well, in the next few days, it's going to be storms every day for the next 3 to 5 days. And then after that, we're going to have to see how this pattern evolves. There's a good thing, though. The good thing is that the way the jet stream is getting set up, pushing that ridge into the Great Lakes, the orientation of the ridge is not the way it's oriented when we go over to super dry summer patterns. So it's going to get hot, but it's also going to be stormy. And that's going to be the critical piece to this upcoming summer pattern. I don't see July showing up cool for us, but at the same time, I don't see it showing up overly dry where it could be detrimental to our crops.
Turn your attention to Europe, actually Ukraine, and then China, please.
All right. So in Ukraine, they started off with a May that was cloudy and cool. They had some regional drought stress going into their planting season. Then we've recently got some rain in that area. So you're not going to hear too much of a negative story. But the next 15 days is showing up as hot and dry, kind of like what the Great Lakes are going to be going into. And given that they didn't have the abundant amount of soil moisture early, there might be some regional stresses in Ukraine we should be watching out for. China's got a very interesting setup. Now, we think about where China grows a lot of its crops that we grow here in the United States. Find Beijing, go to the south of it, go west of it, and then go north of it. And the most productive ground is north of it, into the north of the Korean Peninsula. Good rains north of the Korean Peninsula. South of Beijing, major, major thunderstorm activity and very, very heavy rainfall still in the forecast, flooding out some fields there. So in other words, I guess what I'm trying to say is across the Northern Hemisphere, I think that right now some of the best growing conditions are here in North America, not so much in parts of Europe around the Black Sea. And some of the issues in China, we're going to start to hear this story kind of evolve here because it's been less than ideal in that part of the world.
Turn your attention to the Southern Hemisphere, because two continents now have had a problem. You talked about the locust in Africa, and I think I've seen that they have, and I won't say they moved because I'm sure that's not the case, or at least I don't think it is. But in Argentina now, there are locust plagues, or appear to be.
Yes. So we were talking about the locusts in Africa moving, and they're going to move across the Sahel, which means going across Africa over toward the Atlantic. But they've moved into Pakistan, Iran, and into India. But then we just saw this past week a bunch of videos showing a major locust swarm coming out of northern Argentina going into southern Brazil. And I've heard that it is just consuming everything along its way. And some of the videos, I'll be honest with you, give me chills. In fact, when I pointed this out on Twitter, I had a guy respond back asking me if I was trying to rewrite Revelations. And I said, well, with the Saharan dust and the fires in Siberia and now the locusts in Argentina, it certainly feels like one of those summers where a lot of very strange things are happening. And by the way, one more thing. Be watching the Central Atlantic. Yeah, the dust has pulled through, but watch that Central Atlantic because we might be seeing some tropical development there. And one last thing, I'm sorry, I got one more thing for you. I got an interesting message this morning about the Saharan dust going into the southeast. Remember, that dust does have high mineral content in it from what was a very dry lake bed over in the Saharan Desert. It'll be interesting to see how that dust, when it settles, changes the mineral content of the soil everywhere that it settles here in the United States. It may actually be, believe it or not, a boost to the mineral content. So we got some weird things going on, and I could talk about it for days, but I'll stop right here.
Ooh, we'll let you talk about that again, not next week, because we'll have Friday off as the markets are closed for July 4th, but in 2 weeks.
Sounds good.
Okay, that's Eric Snodgrass. He is with Nutrien Ag Solutions and Agrible. Joined us here on the closing market report for this Friday afternoon. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.